Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Margaret O'Neill. I represent the appellant Sharon Skinner. My bar number is 35932. My primary objective today, judges, is to persuade you that the trial court in this case misinterpreted CRCP 15C with respect to the relation back of Ms. Skinner's amended complaint. I would ask the court to allow me to read specifically the trial court's ruling, which is that the case does not relate back, or 15C does not apply, because plaintiff filed suit against the defendants beyond the statute of limitations. And in my opinion, judges, that is the essence of the trial court's misunderstanding of Rule 15C. It's clear from case law, as well as, of course, a very recent amendment to the rule, that the reasonable time for notice with respect to relation back is not the statute of limitations. Rather, it includes the reasonable time allowed for service of process. Now, up to this point, both parties have cited the 2012 version of this rule, and that, of course, is due to the fact that the amendment was put into effect, I believe, after the responsive brief was filed. The change in the rule does not actually affect the argument, except insofar as it confirms the appellant's interpretation of the rule and more explicitly contradicts the trial court's interpretation or application of the
rule. Counsel, why isn't the mistake alleged here like the mistake at issue in Alvarado, which did not relate back? Can you distinguish that for us?
I believe that that is a concern for the court, and I believe that it can be addressed at the trial court level. My interpretation of the Alvarado as it relates to this case is that in Alvarado, there was a mistake on the part of the plaintiff as to the identity of the entity or the individual that caused her injury. In this instance, Ms. Skinner has no misunderstanding as to the human being or the real cause and fact of her injury, and that was a prescribing pharmacist. The question is, who has legal responsibility for that pharmacist and that pharmacist's negligence?
But wouldn't it have been much more prudent and in fact easier to have brought in the two Kaiser entities and then let them figure out which one was the actual owner of the pharmacy, as opposed to suing the wrong one and then trying to bring in the second one later after the fact?
Without a doubt, Judge, this is a case at the trial level of blundering on the part of plaintiff's counsel. Not only should Kaiser Foundation Health Plan have been brought in immediately, I think that the pharmacist should have been identified. I think that there should have been more investigation done. I cannot answer why that didn't happen. I do believe that that question, though, does go to the reasonableness of the delay, and that that is a subject that the trial court should address in its capacity as a fact finder.
Counsel?
Yes.
Where in the record, though, did you preserve that argument? I don't see any argument in the trial court that there was this related back because there was this reasonable time period for service. It's not there?
Judge, I respect that perspective and understand, I believe, that it comes from the a close reading of the plaintiff's response to defendant's motion to dismiss. My argument in response, however, is that by mere citation of Rule 15C, which includes a reasonableness or a particular definition of the time requirement, that was preservation of the argument.
All right. Even if we agree with you, mm-hmm. I've counted the days. You get 124 days.
Right.
From the complaint to service. And by the way, this is based on something that's, I don't think, properly part of the record, which is this supplemental Exhibit A. But assuming we were to consider it, it's still 124 days. And the Supreme Court has said it's 120 days.
I agree, Judge. And I do want to acknowledge that I believe in my opening brief, I miscalculated and stated it was 118 days. That was actually a calculation from the date of the statute running. The correct time elapse is 124 days. But Judge, I don't believe that the Supreme Court, even in its amendment, has limited it to 24 days. And I'm sorry, not the Supreme Court's amendment, but even the legislature's amendment to Rule 4 and the corollary amendment to Rule 15. I don't believe the limit is 120 days. I believe that it sets a standard of reasonableness, and that the question of reasonableness is very fact specific. I do believe that 124 days stretches both the Colorado Supreme Court and, of course, the federal standard of reasonableness. There isn't a bright line rule yet in Colorado, however. And the question of reasonableness would turn on the conduct of both parties during the pendency of that 124 days, which is not in the appellate record and would have to be reviewed by the trial court.
All right, but all of this assumes that this entity that has been named, this Kaiser entity, is this Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of Colorado, which all your documents relate to. But we have a sworn affidavit that says that this particular entity, Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, Inc., doesn't have any involvement in Colorado or any involvement with the other entity that was sued first. So it looks like there are two different entities, and there's no actual evidence in the record to dispute that.
I agree, Judge. There is no evidence in the record. And frankly, Judge, I still have not been able to unearth evidence to prove that Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, which is the entity that we have sued, is the responsible party. It is a mystery. And we were not allowed, obviously, we have no means of determining that and did not have the means of determining that at the trial level.
Well, that's what the 2 years of the statute of limitations is for. I mean, that's what Lavorado says.
I agree.
That's why you have the time. I mean, it's not just a matter of, oh, there's been a motion filed, I guess we need to investigate now. The investigation is supposed to take place before the complaint's filed.
I absolutely agree, Judge. Again, I would just ask this court to allow the trial court to make a fact-specific finding based on evidence regarding the diligence of the parties, the actions of the parties with respect to that investigation. It could very well be the case, and it is our perspective, Judge, that the defendant is responsible for obfuscating the responsible party.
What's your argument with respect to Mr. Cox? I mean, he's not the person who's even alleged to have filled the prescription, as I understand it. He's just a supervisor of some kind.
Judge, I believe in my review of this case that Mr. Cox is probably not a proper party. Obviously, the doctrine of respondeat superior does not appear to apply to him. Furthermore, there has been more of a delay in service or notice to Mr. Cox, and I think that the reasonableness argument is stretched perhaps beyond its limit with respect to Mr. Cox. And judges, if there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You may.
Good
Good morning, Your Honors. Todd Drake on behalf of the Appalese Kaiser Foundation Health Plan Incorporated and Jeffrey Cox. My bar registration number is 27258. Your Honors, this really is a case of what this case is not about. It's not a case of undisputed facts. It's not a case that presents a novel question of law. Most importantly, it's not a case that involves a mistake. There was no mistake as to the identity of the defendants here, of the proper defendants. There was no reasonable notice given to my clients within either the statute of limitations time period or within the time period for service.
Counsel, given that you raised the issue of reasonable notice, why shouldn't we remand for the trial court to make an explicit finding as to the reasonableness of service as your opponent suggests that we do? Why shouldn't we do that?
Two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, because that issue was not preserved in the trial court. The first time it's been raised is here on appeal. As the court's well aware, it cannot be raised for the first time on appeal. Had they wanted to argue that in the trial court and received guidance from the trial court or a ruling as to the reasonableness of that time period and what it was within the reasonable time for service, they could have raised that. They chose not to, and they're now raising it for the first time here. Secondly, Judge Jones, as you point out, it's beyond the 120 days anyway. I would submit that under Colorado law, sending it back to the trial court would just be an exercise in futility. The Colorado Supreme Court in Garcia has said they have essentially adopted the federal rule 15C in the 120 days time period for reasonable service. Here, as Judge Jones pointed out, it's 124 days for the entity for when Kaiser Foundation Health Plan Incorporated was given or was served with the amended complaint. And I think as Judge Jones, as you point out, I suppose it's the one dispute in the case is that, again, that was not an issue that was presented to the trial court because actually the date that we were working with in the trial court was August 29th. Of 2012 when Mr. Cox was served and when it was understood that Kaiser Foundation Health Plan was served. It was only after the trial court, 8 months after the trial court had dismissed this case, that Ms. Skinner's counsel filed this return of service that said, no, we actually served Health Plan back on August 14th. So to Ms. O'Neill's point that if 139 days is too long for Mr. Cox, it's not within the reasonable period of service. Well, it's also not within the reasonable period of service for Kaiser Foundation Health Plan either.
Counsel, does the record in this case substantiate that anyone associated with the correct Kaiser entity and who had authority to bind that entity provided misinformation to the plaintiff or to her representatives?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And again, I appreciate that question because, again, I think this is a new issue that really wasn't raised in the trial court, this idea that somehow Ms. Skinner was misled into believing that Colorado Permanente Medical Group was the proper entity. The phone call that is alleged to have occurred with the paralegal from Ms. Skinner's attorney's firm was with someone at the Wheat Ridge Pharmacy. We don't know who it was. We don't know when it was. We don't know how long it took. We don't know any of the specifics of that. But what is clear is that none of that conversation occurred with anyone from Kaiser Foundation Health Plan Incorporated. It didn't include a conversation with Mr. Cox. It didn't even include anyone from Colorado Permanente Medical Group, the original defendant, because Colorado Permanente Medical Group has nothing to do with that pharmacy. As to your point, Judge Jones, we still, as we sit here today, the proper entity that owns and operates Colorado-based pharmacies for Kaiser is not before this court. It's Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of Colorado. That is what the paralegal for Ms. Skinner's counsel, what he was told when he called, it's Mr. Price, George Price, when he indicated it's in his affidavit, when he called and tried to call the Colorado Pharmacy Board and he said, who is it that owns and operates this pharmacy? He was told it's Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of Colorado. They then chose to sue Kaiser Foundation Health Plan Incorporated, a California corporation that has nothing to do with these pharmacies. So back to the point, to your point, Judge Fox, no, there was no misrepresentation from anyone before this court, certainly from my clients. In fact, there was no information of any kind given. My clients Mr. Cox, Kaiser Foundation Health Plan Incorporated, had absolutely zero knowledge of any of this until they were served with the amended complaint 139 days after the original complaint was filed and more than 4 months after the statute of limitations had expired. It's to your point, this case is clearly consistent with Alvarado, Your Honor, and Judge Jones, I know you're familiar with Alvarado, having authored the opinion. As you pointed out, in that case, it is not a situation, it's not a mistake when a party simply fails to identify the proper entity or the proper defendant, or ignorance or misunderstanding as to it is not a mistake. And more importantly, as you point out, Judge Jones, in that opinion, it is the plaintiff's burden to go and determine who is liable for their injury and to do so within the expiration of the statute of limitations. One of the key issues in this case, Your Honors, is much as in Alvarado, the plaintiff in this case or counsel, they chose to wait until the last minute. They wait till the eve of the statute of limitations to try and investigate who are the proper defendants and to file a complaint. Again, how we know this is not a mistake, all you need to do is look at that affidavit from Mr. Price that's found in the record at page 60 and 61. Mr. Price says, I was asked to assist in preparing this complaint. I began my investigation in April 2012. He began his investigation just weeks before the statute of limitations was going to expire. He says that he had this conversation with someone at the Wheat Ridge Pharmacy. That was the extent of his investigation. He didn't call the Colorado Pharmacy Board. He made no attempt to in any way determine who was the proper entity that owns and operates that pharmacy. This simply was not a mistake that allows for relation back. The other issues, we focus a lot on the mistake component, and I think we should, because there clearly is no mistake here. But the other component that's required for relation back is that my clients had notice within the time frame, within the statute of limitations, or as Ms. O'Neill has now argued, that it is within the reasonable time period. Again, Judge Jones, as you point out, there simply was, the trial court's already made this ruling. Trial court found the facts do not support that these defendants knew or should have known that the action was brought against them. That's at the record, page 87. That's the trial court's finding. There's nothing to suggest that if it was somehow raised in the trial court that, no, Your Honor, you need to also consider the 120 days for reasonable amount of service, that would have changed the view of the trial court. The trial court converted this from a motion to dismiss. We filed it as a motion to dismiss based solely on the allegations of the complaint. Ms. Skinner's counsel then went ahead and submitted a number of things, including Mr. Price's affidavit. So we submitted affidavits from our clients, making it clear their first notice of this litigation was August 29th, 2012, 139 days after the original complaint was filed and well past the statute of limitations. There simply is, those are undisputed facts. There's no evidence to contradict that in any way within the record. So this idea of sending it back to the trial court to go ahead and redetermine this, it's simply unsupported. The one other issue, Your Honors, and I don't know that it certainly wasn't raised by Ms. O'Neill in her argument, it is in their brief, but is this idea of an identity of interest between the corporate entities. Judge Jones, as you point out, this certainly doesn't relate to Mr. Cox. I'm not given Ms. O'Neill's statement that she doesn't believe Mr. Cox is a proper defendant in this action. I'm focusing on the entities here. But even if you accept, first of all, identity of interest, that exception is a federal exception. It's only been recognized once in Colorado. That's in the Spiker case back in 1981. And a review of the Spiker case demonstrates that what that doctrine, that exception is for substitutions of parties. Substitution, much like in the Dillingham case that plaintiff has also cited. It's essentially just taking one corporate entity. In Spiker, it was a corporation that was sued that had been a partnership at the time of the complaint when the claim arose. All they did was essentially substitute the corporate or the partnership for the corporation. It's not an exception that can be used in a situation like this where you have separate entities that have no relation to each other. The undisputed evidence before this court, before the trial court, is that they are different companies. Colorado Permanente Medical Group is incorporated here in Colorado. Kaiser Foundation Health Plan Incorporated is in California. They have different ownership. They have different management. In fact, they don't even do the same business. The medical group is a professional corporation of physicians. It has nothing to do with health insurance, which is what Kaiser Foundation Health Plan does. They don't share income. They don't share any corporate structure or any of the other corporate formalities that would allow this identity of interest exception to apply. And most importantly, even if we were to somehow accept this identity of interest exception somehow applies in Colorado, it still requires that my clients, that Kaiser Foundation Health Plan Incorporated, had notice of the lawsuit within the statute of limitations. That's clear. That's under Spiker. It's under those federal cases. We're right back to the first issue. They didn't have notice within the statute of limitations or even within that reasonable time period for service afterwards. One thing Ms. Skinner, or counsel actually acknowledges this in their opening brief, page 11, noting that these are separate corporate identities, given that there is no identity of interest, Your Honors. Your Honors, this is a case, I think it's very clear. It's not a case of mistake. It's a case of delay, of inattention, of a lack of diligence. It's a case in which a proper investigation was not done prior to the statute of limitations expiring. It's a case in which, unfortunately, Ms. Skinner's claims had expired by the time she tried to bring them against my clients. Given that, given the fact that my clients had no notice of this litigation within the statute of limitations period or within the reasonable time period, we ask that this court affirm the trial court and the reversal, or excuse me, the dismissal of Ms. Skinner's claims. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Drake. Ms. O'Neill.
With respect to the identity of interest raised by counsel, I believe that there are too many unanswered questions about the relationship, the business relationship between these entities. We know that Kaiser Permanente of Colorado is an organization that contains within it the first entity that was named by Ms. Skinner and the second entity currently before this court, Kaiser Foundation Health Plan. In other words, Kaiser Permanente of Colorado is an umbrella organization. We are not aware of its corporate structure. Toward that end, judges, we are also not aware of the relationship between the counsel for these entities and the corporation. And the issue of notice, judges, should not be confused with the issue of service. Notice and service are not the same with respect to relation back. The timeliness of notice relates to service of process. However, in this instance, notice can be formal, it can be informal, it can even be constructive notice. And so again, the question is a matter of fact that the trial court simply did not reach. Defense counsel, as the record shows, for this entity, the entity before the court today, was served only 80 days after the original complaint, which is well within the 120 days, which I believe is a watermark or a benchmark, but not a bright line rule.
Ms. O'Neill, in yes. light of the affidavit from Kaiser Foundation Health Plan Incorporated, mm-hmm. The corporate representative, in light of that affidavit, how did the trial court have an ability to do anything other than to dismiss?
That affidavit,
it was unrebutted, and maybe your client couldn't rebut it, but it stands unrebutted.
Exactly, and that's exactly the point, Judge. That affidavit was submitted after the response, and we did not have an opportunity to rebut it. And furthermore, we did not have the ability to conduct any fact-finding. I agree entirely that 2 years statute of limitations is an ample period of time to do investigation. Unless a business entity is organized in such a manner that essentially it is a corporate secret or it is a business secret, it is privileged information, what relationships these entities have with one another. There is no means of making those determinations without discovery in a case like this.
But what about the Secretary of State records? Mm-hmm. I mean, they identify who the agent for service of process was. So
yes.
Why couldn't that agent for Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, Inc. have been served? And why couldn't the...
That agent was served.
I guess timely served. Timely served.
She is the same agent. The same agent is registered for the original entity and for
and
the
is there
entity
legal
before
significance
the court.
To that? To the fact that they have the same... I mean, don't a lot of corporations have this...
Yes,
this?
Judge. Absolutely. That's true. She may very well be a registered agent for, and I'm sure she is, for hundreds of entities. But she was served, and that's the only way we had of reaching the entity at that point. Again, it goes back to the availability of information. It just simply is not available in public records. It is not available even with the assistance of a private investigator, necessarily. It certainly isn't to our knowledge. So again, I ask the court to direct the trial court to collect additional evidence regarding the relationships of these parties, what constitutes notice with respect to these two entities, and whether that was reasonable given the conduct of the parties.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Ms. O'Neill. Thanks to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.